This episode of the Dub De Dub Review is sponsored by Magical Mara Designs. Do you enjoy showing off your love of Disney by wearing Mickey or Minnie ears, but get tired of wearing ones that are uncomfortable and give you headaches? Check out the made-to-order ear designs at MagicalMaraDesigns.com. We've got cute and comfortable Minnie and Mickey ears made to order. We've got Maleficent to Beauty and the Beast, Adventureland to Star Wars Land. Check them out at MagicalMaraDesigns.com.
Hello, welcome to the Dub De Dub Review, and I'm your host, Chris Malik. Today, I'm joined with a special guest co-host today, so this gentleman's not been on before with us, and I've got to tell you, I'm super excited today. You know, I mentioned that we have guests that cover certain topics. We just talked to Chris Lucas about his book, Top Disney, and you know, when you come on the show, I want to go and talk about something that you're passionate about. But this is the full disclosure. About a year ago, I was contacted by an author who had a couple books and wanted to send me some books to review. And you know what? I do get books periodically in the mail. But what made this different was simply the topic. So as we're all amateur Disney historians, one of the things that I'm most passionate about is learning about the history of the Disney parks. But not necessarily what's in the Disney parks now, but what came before. But not necessarily what came before, what was scheduled to go in and never quite made it there. So I want to read just briefly from the back of the book before I introduce our host. Okay, I'm going to read from the back cover. On an alternate Earth, Walt Disney World guests are taking in the thrills of Thunder Mesa, braving the Beastly Kingdom, marveling at Villains Mountain, and staying the night at Disney's Persian Resort. You want to join them? This is your guidebook to the theme park that Disney never built. Now tell me, that is not the coolest first paragraph for the back of a book you've heard in a long time. So without any further delay, I want to introduce Chris Smith. Chris, how are you?
Hey, Chris, man, I'm doing great. Big fan of the show and really looking forward to talking about some cool Disney things. And to your point, you know, I've written a few other books on different topics, and you know, some of those topics, some Disney fans love, and others, you know, they're not quite so passionate about. But this concept of what never came to be, literally every Disney fan I talk to is fascinated by that subject.
Why are we fascinated? What is the reason behind that? Because I tried to like verbalize it, and I know I didn't do a great job. Why is it that like when I read about Thunder Mesa from you, which is frankly it's chapter one, like my mind is like I literally the emoji, the mind exploding emojis going off as I'm reading the entire chapter. Why is that?
You know, I think, Chris, that it really goes back to just kind of the passion that we all have as Disney fans for the parks, right? And I think we get excited when new concepts are announced for the parks, like the Star Wars Galaxy's Edge expansion and Pandora. And so we're always looking for that new thing. And then when you start hearing about and thinking about and imagining all these just wonderful ideas for lands and attractions and shops that were dreamed up over the years but never actually came to be, really that just sparks your imagination, I think, and wondering, man, you know, what could have been and how great some of these ideas could have been if they were actually implemented into the parks.
So before we start on with the Walt Disney World That Never Was, which is the book that I'm looking at, you have other books. What else have you written, Chris?
I do. So I have, I've got a series that I've started called The Backstories and Magical Secrets of Walt Disney World. And now there's two volumes out that collectively cover the Magic Kingdom. And what those are, I had just a ton of fun writing those books, is it looks at kind of the backstories for the lands and the attractions and the shops that are located in the parks, volumes 1 and 2 for the Magic Kingdom, and really all the details and secrets and everything you could possibly find. You know, I joke that if you want to know what each box in the queue of Big Thunder Mountain Railroad actually means what those references are, then these are the books for you, right? And I've seen, what was funny is I kind of, you know, I'm a huge fan of Disney history like you are, and a huge fan of Disney details. And you can read about some of these details in different books and articles and magazines, but I had not found kind of what I thought was just a definitive resource for as many of these backstories. So if I'm looking at Main Street USA, I want to know everything that I possibly can about that land. And so that's what I set out to do. And my publisher almost killed me when I told him that, you know, because the Magic Kingdom has so many things that I had to divide it into two volumes. But that was a ton of fun to write and has gotten a great response. My fourth book is a little bit of a different take on things, which is essentially a travel guide. And it's called the Walt Disney World Attraction Guide. And it came out for 2019 and will be updated year over year. But in looking at, you know, all the different travel guides that are out there, you know, I think one of the most important parts for most fans who are visiting Walt Disney World are the attractions, right? I mean, people want to experience these attractions. There's only maybe a paragraph or two of information about what's out there. So I said, I'm going to create a guide that does nothing but focus on attractions. You know, so everything you could possibly want to know, whether it's details about the experience, whether it's boarding procedures if you happen to have a mobility issue or other disability, you know, best times of the day to visit those and touring strategies. So it's a really deep dive of visiting the parks and focusing on attractions.
You make a good point about the attractions. And, you know, some people are fans of the resorts, some people are fans of the attractions, but I wanted to touch base on something you said not more than like 30 seconds ago. It was about the details of the boxes in Big Thunder Mountain. So that's like, if I could give a tip, if my show ended tomorrow, if Stacy, Pete, and I no longer did it, and you no longer wrote a book, I think what we would want to tell people is like, slow down and like absorb the details, because they were put there intentionally. And it's so easy to like walk by. It'd be so easy to ignore these details, but you're missing so much. Like, the information is there, and like the Imagineers wanted you to see it, but they made you have to work for it. It wasn't just spilled out over you. You have to, the windows on Main Street. Why do the windows say, oh my gosh, that's right, he used to be the engineer. Oh my gosh, he was the, you know, the person in charge of finances. That's why he's called bank manager. So pay attention to the details and slow down. So,
I couldn't agree more. And not to go on a tangent, I know we're not talking about
tangent Chris, go.
You know, we're not talking about my backstories, Magical Secrets series, but really kind of the purpose of that is to do what you just said, is to cause people to stop, look up, look down, look around, listen to the music, notice the architecture. Because, you know, I think we all love Walt Disney World, and I'm a theme park fan in general, right? I love going to Six Flags and Cedar Point and other areas, but I think we can all agree that Disney is different. And when I started thinking about what makes it different, it's really that storytelling emphasis that they had as a film company before they were an amusement park company. Mm-hmm. And they have rolled out that storytelling emphasis throughout the parks. And the way they do that is in these different details, whether it's a box in the queue or the architecture of a building or the music that plays in a certain land. And unfortunately, most Disney fans don't notice that as they're going through the parks. And because of that, they don't get that full experience that I think that those of us who do take the time to see those items and take notice of them do. And so when it's an enhanced area of an enjoyment. So yes, I completely agree with you. The biggest piece of advice I can give anyone going to visit the Disney parks is to slow down just a little bit and take notice of all these wonderful details that are spread throughout the parks.
All right. So we got through that. Now let's pull out your original guidebook, your guidebook of things that never were. And I can't wait to talk about this. So where do you want to start, Chris? I want to give you open rein because I've read most of the book, so I don't want to spoil it, and I just want to shush and let you talk because I'm super excited. Let's talk. Let's start with Thunder Mesa. Can we do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, the way I describe Thunder Mesa is if, you know, the Walt Disney World that never was a Sports Hall of Fame, then Thunder Mesa would be Babe Ruth. I mean, it really is kind of the big idea that never came to be. And, you know, while a lot of Disney fans out there, I think, have heard, you know, the term Thunder Mesa or bits and pieces about it, I think there's a lot of confusion in terms of what the concept and the idea would have been. But for me, any discussion about Thunder Mesa begins with a gentleman named Mark Davis. And, you know, a lot of Disney fans are familiar with that name. But even for those who are not familiar with Mark Davis, I'm sure they're familiar with his work. And so, you know, Mark is, you know, was a, you know, he's passed away now, but he's a Disney legend and started off with the company in their animation department. And just his career in animation alone, I tell people that if you feel like you want, if you want to make yourself feel bad about not having accomplished a lot in your life, just look at Mark's resume just on the animation side. He brought to life some of Disney's most notable animated characters, you know, Cinderella and Snow White and Aurora and Alice from Alice in Wonderland, and you know, and developed a reputation, as you can probably tell from that list, as being kind of the go-to animator for notable female characters in Disney's animated films. Well, he eventually transitioned duties over to the you know, what's now the Imagineering side, but essentially the design phase for Disneyland, the design team. And he's most notable for being very influential in the creation of the Haunted Mansion and really his crowning jewel, Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, think about that, Chris. I mean, how about having your name associated with just those two attractions from a theme park perspective?
I'd be happy to sell churros for you know.
that's right. And you know, what he became known as, what Walt Disney himself referred to Mark as his Renaissance man, essentially the guy who could do anything. Okay. So when you flash forward to, you know, the mid to late 1960s, when the Disney company is looking to expand to the east, right? So to expand beyond the Disneyland Park in California, I think it's really important, Chris, you know, when you talk about these things, to kind of try to put things in historical perspective, because now, you know, the Disney company is an expert in theme parks, and they have parks across the globe, and really they know the process as well as any company can. But back then, you know, it was a big step for them to open up another park across the country. And so they really faced this tough battle of what attractions do we create new versus attractions we replicate that are already represented in Disneyland. Well, one of the new concepts was called Thunder Mesa. And what really gets me excited about the concept is Mark Davis, and we know this from the research and from the documents that are out there, that Mark Davis, this brilliant Imagineer, set the goal of creating the greatest Disney attraction concept ever when he sat down to do Thunder Mesa.
That's not too lofty, right? That's not too impressive,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and when you have a guy like that with a resume like his and the attractions that he's worked on, when he sets that goal, and really, I think it's fair to say that Thunder Mesa was Mark Davis's passion project. Even more so than the other attractions he's associated with. I mean, that just kind of tells you what type of significance this could have had. Now, a lot of people think that Thunder Mesa was an attraction per se, and that's not really accurate. It was essentially going to be a subland almost of Frontierland. Okay. and would have been composed of several different attraction offerings. You know, the star was called the Western River Expedition, which would have been a Wild West version of Pirates of the Caribbean. And there would have also been a runaway mine train type attraction, hiking trails, and it would have been all housed in this enormous show building that would have run essentially from, if you know where, you know, the Briar Patch gift store is, you know, near the entrance of Splash Mountain, all the way through the entire footprint of the current Big Thunder Mountain Railroad, coaster today, and just would have been massive, right? Mm-hmm. It would have completely changed the landscape of not only Frontierland, I think, but really the Magic Kingdom as a whole. And, you know, some of these concepts that never came to be, you know, they kind of run the gamut of, you know, just original ideas versus things that were literally on the doorstep of being created. Well, what's wonderful about Thunder Mesa is that we have just a wealth of information and artistic renderings and different concepts about, you know, that were used in planning the project. So we have a really good idea of what all of these things would have looked like and felt like. And it's really an exciting concept.
Was Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland, was that operational when they were planning this? Was that part inspiration for the Western River attraction?
Yeah, so that's actually a very... A very good question. And so at the time, as you know, Chris, Pirates of the Caribbean and Disneyland was hands down that park's most popular attraction. And really, Pirates was, it's almost a cultural phenomenon at the time, because it was featured on, you know, Disney's, you know, television show, and the people who went to the parks could not get enough of it. But in planning, in that planning process I talked about earlier for Walt Disney, what became known as Walt Disney World, you know, Disney executives decided to not replicate Pirates in Florida. And the reason for that was, strangely enough, they felt like because of the proximity of Florida to the real Caribbean, that it would not have been a unique enough experience. Hmm. But surely, and you can tell from the concept artwork, I'm sure that the Pirates attraction as it existed in Disneyland kind of influenced, you know, some of the work on Western River Expedition, specifically for Thunder Mesa, because it did have that, you know, Mark Davis's signature humor incorporated in it, and these funny scenes and different renderings that we see that Mark worked on. So I do think there was a close connection.
Okay.
Now, you know, one of the big themes for concepts that never came to be are construction costs. Okay. So once you know the Magic Kingdom was underway, I mean, we're talking about the largest construction project in the history of the United States at the time, right? I mean, a massive, massive project. And as you can probably expect, costs were just running out of control.
Sure.
And so some cuts had to be made. And so Thunder Mesa being, you know, just this amazing concept with all these different components, you know, it carried with it, you know, a pretty hefty price tag. And so executives made the decision to kind of cut it from the opening day plans. But once, you know, this flood of revenue came in from the parks after it opened, it would be incorporated in what Disney referred to as phase one, the first 5 years the park was open.
Okay.
Well, guess what happens, Chris, on day one and soon thereafter when the Magic Kingdom opens? You have this flood of fans that come into the park, and what do they want to see? They want to see Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, man.
You know, they want to see this wonderful ride that they've seen on television, heard about from their friends from California. And really the swell of public demand, I really can't overstate it, you know, really pushed the Disney team, the Disney executives to, all right, we've got to have a Pirates attraction. And so they fast-tracked that project. What's sad to me about Thunder Mesa is that, you know, certainly having Pirates of the Caribbean constructed hurt its chances of becoming a reality. But, you know, there was still, Disney continued to advertise it in marketing materials and continued to reference the project in its corporate disclosure documents. And so there was this hope that Thunder Mesa would become a reality still out there for years, but it kept taking, you know, multiple hits. You know, the OPEC oil embargo of the early 70s and the financial trickle down that had on people visiting the parks. And some somewhat controversial, you know, depictions of Native Americans in the scenes, you know, similar to what was used in the film Peter Pan, but certainly, you know, what, you know, the political correctness standard had changed from the 1950s to the 1970s. And so these things just kept happening over and over and over. And really, I think what was the death knell of the project, and it's kind of an infamous story, is the creation of Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. And the story there is that Disney executives were touring the Imagineering headquarters and come across the Thunder Mesa model, and they asked a young Tony Baxter, you know, what he thought about the project, and Tony kind of touted the runaway mine train coaster component as opposed to the entire Thunder Mesa concept. And that project was greenlit. And so when you have a runaway coaster there already, and you have a Pirates of the Caribbean ride, mm-hmm. and then you're also heading into the time period where Epcot is going to start being constructed, you know, the project just could never get off the ground. But man, to sit back and think about what Frontierland could have looked like, what the Western River Expedition could have been, just this hilarious Old West boat ride. You know, it's kind of, it tugs at you, makes you wish you could have seen that. The flip side of that coin, though, is that, you know, two of my very favorite attractions and all of Walt Disney World are Splash Mountain and Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. And I think it's fair to say that if we would have gotten Thunder Mesa, we would not have gotten either of those attractions, at least in the concept and in the form that we do see today.
I do have a follow-up question, and I'm not trying to dig up dirt. Was there resentment for Mark Davis to Tony Baxter during that play right there? Was there like a, oh my gosh, what just happened type situation?
Absolutely, Chris. Okay. And it's really a shame, because I think anyone who has ever met Tony Baxter will tell you that he's just the nicest guy in the world.
Gotcha.
Right? And I think I don't think his intent was to submarine, you know, Mark's Thunder Mesa project. It just kind of happened. And based on what I've heard and the people I've talked to, he felt horrible about it and attempted on many times to apologize to Mark. I don't think that Mark ever got over that.
Gotcha.
And I don't know that there was ever a reconciliation. But one of the really cool – I'm glad you asked me that question, because one of the really cool things that happened was a couple of years ago at a D23 conference – Tony Baxter actually gave a pretty lengthy discussion on Thunder Mesa and was very complimentary of Mark and his ideas. And really, we saw a lot of things during that presentation that we didn't know before about Thunder Mesa. But to your back to your question, unfortunately, I think that caused some very hard feelings that I don't know that were ever resolved.
Mm. And I could see how that situation would play out. Now, this has no base in fact whatsoever, but if a Disney exec comes into the room and, you know, grabs Tony Baxter and says, "Tony, what fires you up? What are you most passionate about?" He's going to go to, you know, the first thing he thinks of, and he doesn't realize the weight or what kind of order he is and how he could sell this one particular piece. And before you know it, he grabbed the right ear grabbed the other right ear, and before you knew it, the wheels were in motion without actually really realizing what he was doing, you know? So I could I could see how that could happen.
That's right. And really one of my I'll just kind of just back up and give you a little background in terms of how the Walt Disney World That Never Was, my book, is structured. So for each of these concepts, including Thunder Mesa, I talk about, you know, how the original idea, you know, came to be, what we know about it. So if it's an attraction, what we think the ride experience would have been, why it actually never came to be. And then finally, the last and maybe my favorite piece of the book is where you can find kind of hidden tributes and different homages to some of these old attractions that didn't make it off the drawing board in the parks today. Mm-hmm. And the reason that was important to me is, and I think this is getting to your point, I mean, Imagineers really poured their heart and souls into a lot of these projects. And, you know, and for them to not come to be for a guy like Thunder Mesa, a guy like Mark Davis and a project like Thunder Mesa, even though he had accomplished so much, I think it was a heartbreaking thing for Mark. Mm-hmm. And what I want to try to do is kind of shed some light on this. And, you know, and as someone who's kind of walking through the Big Thunder Mesa or the Big Thunder Mountain queue, and you see a little poster that references Thunder Mesa or it references Western River Expedition, which all those are present, you know what that means, and it pays homage and honors these Imagineering ideas that never made it off the drawing board.
It's special. So, yeah, again, it goes back to our pay attention to those little details. Wonderful. Let's stay in the Magic Kingdom. What else can you tell us about the Magic Kingdom, Chris?
Yeah, so one of the fun things I like is, and this again circles back to what we talked about before in terms of kind of planning attractions for the opening day of the Magic Kingdom. And, you know, when the Magic Kingdom first opened in 1971, you had three different dark rides. You had Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, you had Snow White's Adventures, which later became Snow White's Scary Adventures, and you had Peter Pan's Flight, which, as we all know, remains one of the most popular attractions in the entire park.
Heck yeah. Wait lines are crazy, you know?
It's one of my favorites, and it's amazing how, except for the queue, it has been barely touched since opening day, and yet it still resonates with people so much. But Disney executives actually planned on having three completely different dark rides in lieu of those, a Mary Poppins-based attraction, a Sleeping Beauty-based attraction, and then an attraction based off the Legend of Sleepy Hollow instead of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. And it's just really fun to think about how different, you know, Fantasyland would have looked if that would have happened. And again, because of you know, construction costs and expenses going out of control, it was cheaper for the company to replicate the attractions that did open with the Magic Kingdom rather than having to redesign new concepts. But this Sleepy Hollow attraction in particular is one that fascinates me because you know, it would have taken you obviously on a spooky ride and a jack-o'-lantern type ride vehicle through Sleepy Hollow and certainly an encounter with the Headless Horseman. You know, I wonder sometimes how that would have fit in with Fantasyland as opposed to maybe Liberty Square, which might have made more sense. But what's also interesting, Chris, is when you look at, you know, all of those three concepts that didn't make it in and the three rides that did make it in, all of those, you know, except for Toad and Sleepy Hollow, are based on what I think are classic full-length Disney films, right? So, you know, Sleepy Hollow and Mary Poppins, you know, live-action animation combo. But when you look at The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and the influence that that work has had on the Magic Kingdom, I think you can argue it's had a bigger impact than any of those films, right? From the inspiration to the Haunted Mansion's architecture and, you know, the Sleepy Hollow refreshments and the Headless Horseman riding and the Halloween party. You know, I think it's had a significant impact on the parks, maybe more so than a lot of major animated films. And we did almost get that dark ride that I would have loved to have seen there in the parks.
Well, so as soon as you're saying this, I keep on thinking in the back of my mind, there's a kernel that says, but it still might happen. even as we talk about these things, I know the recent trend is to tie them into current IPs and things that are, you know, are really popular. But, you know, as amateur Disney historians, you know, they like to think, like no good idea ever really dies. It just kind of waits until, you know, it fully fleshes it out. So what's the chances of things like this actually coming around? I wouldn't put it off the table. Would you?
No, and Chris, I'm really disappointed in myself because you beat me to one of my major one of the major things, my books before I got to it. But you're exactly right. I mean, you know, one of the overarching themes of the book is that good ideas and great ideas never truly die. And I like to imagine, you know, an old library, an old imagineering library where all these great ideas are sitting on a shelf, just waiting for someone to come and dust them off, put them into the parks. And I think we've seen a history of ideas not being implemented, but a few years going down the road, the ideas coming down, changed a little bit and put into the parks. The difference now is, and you brought up intellectual properties, you know, there's such an IP heavy focus today that, you know, you're just less likely to get original ideas. Now, Sleepy Hollow is tied to an IP franchise. It's not quite as popular as some of the others. So I think thematically it would be fantastic to have, a Sleepy Hollow based something in Liberty Square, in addition to the counter service restaurant that's there now. But, you know, again, people will complain, especially with Bob Iger's comments recently about Expedition Everest, that, you know, that a lot of these ideas that didn't get implemented will stay that way because of lack of an IP focus. But, you know, if you look at it, you know, I would say even Frozen Ever After, right? And I talk about this in the book. You know, going back to Mark Davis, he had had plans for an attraction called the Enchanted Snow Palace in Fantasyland that would have been in contention for the most beautiful show buildings in Walt Disney World period, right? This glimmering ice tower in the heart of Fantasyland, and based on the same Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that inspired Frozen many years later. And so even with that IP focus, I still think there's a chance you see some of these old ideas, but maybe with an IP theme incorporated into the original ideas.
Now you got my interest piqued about the Ice Palace. So let's hear about it. I want to hear more about this Ice Palace.
Yeah. So again, this is another Mark Davis concept. And, And you know, again, from a show building perspective, it would have been gorgeous. But the actual attraction itself would have been similar to Pirates of the Caribbean and the Western River Expedition that we just talked about. And there was a boat ride that would take you through these different, you know, Arctic type scenes with, you know, very fanciful type ride. You know, it would certainly belong in Fantasyland with penguins and polar bears and ice fairies and all these fun things. Before ultimately coming to an encounter with the Snow Queen. And again, it would have been beautiful. While it didn't happen, this was kind of thought of in the early to mid 70s, is that at that time, Fantasyland, really more so than many of the other areas of the parks, was really fully fleshed out for the most part in terms of attractions and offerings. And there was also a push towards more, you know, more, I guess, teen adult type offerings. And so it just never quite made it off the drawing board. It was actually considered for both Walt Disney World and for Disneyland. And again, one of the reasons Mark wanted to do this was, hey, you know, it's also a cool place inside for people to come in out of the hot sun. Mm-hmm. But again, for a couple of different reasons, it never actually got constructed.
So one could even make an argument that way before Maelstrom was even thought of, actually Frozen Ever After in a various incarnation was actually brainstormed beforehand, because it sounds just like how Frozen Ever After is laid out. You have, you know, fantastic and fanciful boats ultimately taking you to, you know, the Ice Queen, and yeah, you meet Sven as opposed to penguins and whatnot, but boy, that sounds just like its brother, if anything else, right?
But isn't it amazing to think about that? You know, nobody, including the Disney company, had any idea that the original Frozen film was going to be the runaway success that it turned out to be. And you saw this, you know, that the Disney company rushed to implement as many Frozen type things as they could into the parks following that success. And it's just so funny to think that, wow, decades earlier, you know, one of Disney's brilliant minds had this idea for a similar type concept based on the same fairy tale, but they decided not to move forward with it. So it's just funny to think about that and kind of the aftermath of that rush to get Frozen into the park as quickly as they could.
Okay, so we're circling Magic Kingdom. We talked a little bit about Thunder Mesa, and we're off on, you know, in that side of the park. We're talking about Fantasyland. We're over a little bit more towards that side of the park. We talked briefly on Liberty Square. What do you have for Tomorrowland? Do you have anything for Tomorrowland?
Yes, one of the most interesting stories of things that never came to be is focused in Tomorrowland. And the way I like to set up the story is you know, I think the Magic Kingdom, more so maybe than any other place on Earth, is this fanciful place of just, you know, wonder and innocence and laughter and happiness. And so there's no way in the world that the Disney company would have thought about incorporating an attraction based on an R-rated film into a place like that. Well, that's exactly what they did during the Michael Eisner era. You know, they thought about incorporating an attraction based on the 1979 film Alien, right? Which was, you know, certainly a groundbreaking sci-fi film. And, you know, when Michael Eisner, you know, I think Disney fans, you know, have a love-hate relationship with Eisner, depending upon what they like and what they don't like. But Eisner's focus when he came on board was, listen, we have got to make the parks more attractive to a teen and adult audience. And the way you do that is you focus on thrill attraction, you focused on attractions that have, you know, more adult type content. And so, you know, this concept went through a couple of different iterations. One was it was called Nostromo, which was the name of the ship in Alien, where you would literally come into contact with the alien from that film. And as you can imagine, Chris, the reception to that type of idea from some of Disney's Imagineers was just shock. You know, they could not believe that it was even being considered. Other Imagineers thought, hey, this isn't, you know, too bad of an idea. But it kind of morphed and changed. And I think that it was literally based on the research that I've done. I think an attraction closer to that 1979 film was on the way to being constructed when Eisner just decided at the last minute to not pull the trigger on it. Now, we did get an alien attraction not based on the film, you know, extraterrestrial alien encounter, which I think in of itself is one of the most controversial attractions that Disney has ever implemented into the parks. But it was, as the name implied, with the all capital terror in the name, was a little more frightening than what I think Magic Kingdom fans were used to, but nowhere near what, you know, a Nostromo attraction would have been. And again, I think today, even the attraction that was constructed, I think you have a split amongst Disney fans about whether or not it was great or not. But again, just think about that, Chris. Let's take the most magical place on Earth where children just go and have fun and laugh, and let's add an attraction based on an R-rated film. That in of itself kind of shocked me to some extent, but that's absolutely what happened, and it almost came to be.
Well, and one could argue that they absolutely would not let it go. And in fact, for years, it was one of the headline scenes in the Great Movie Ride. They just simply would not let that go. It was perhaps the most fun scene, having the alien drop from the ceiling as you're hearing the buzzer ringing in your ears and you know you're in trouble. So, fantastic.
That's right.
So, can I ask you this? What was the motivation? Do you know, at that point, Michael Eisner's motivation to create an intense experience completely unlike anything else in the park? Was it a reaction to Universal starting to acquire, build, brainstorm, think about potentially building a competitor park? Or what was the motivation at that point?
You know, really, I think it was just kind of Eisner's, you know, instinct for the theme park market at that point. And I also think, you know, kind of the big rumor that you hear, and I reference this in the book, even though there's nothing to substantiate it, is that at the time, his teenage son Breck, would join him on trips to meetings with Imagineers, and the things that really got Breck excited were the things that Michael Eisner got excited about. Mm. And you know, if they saw a concept that was in development and Breck was kind of yawning, you know, why would we want to do that? I think that influenced Eisner. And I'll say this, I think from a business perspective, you know, people, and I have to kind of take a step back when I say this, you know, nobody loves Walt Disney World more than I do. And I'm very passionate about it and I'm very protective of it. But I also recognize the reality that at the end of the day, the Disney Company is a corporation and is a business. And its business is to make money and has shareholders that it has to report to. That's tough for a lot of people to see and to kind of come to grips with. But Eisner, I think the business sense was there in terms of, hey, if we can make the parks more appealable to a larger range of potential guests, then hey, we, at the end of the day, we can be more profitable. I don't see an issue with that. However, that particular concept that was considered to accomplish that goal, I think was not the best option they could have come up with.
So before we actually leave the Magic Kingdom, I want to repeat right now, it's the Walt Disney World That Never Was with Christopher Smith. So Amazon, Chris, is this where you sell it at, or where can people find the book?
Sure. So they can get all of my books on Amazon, or they can visit my website, chrissmithbooks.com. And I'll also say if they're fans of Disney history and early construction photos or some of those great details that we've talked about, they can give me a follow at Twitter at @CSmithDisney, because I'm constantly posting some of those old development pictures as well.
Outstanding. So I want to leave the Magic Kingdom, and my initial reaction, even our battle plan before we started recording, was let's talk about the Magic Kingdom and Epcot. And I realize Epcot's got just as much as the Magic Kingdom, so I don't want to. Maybe we can save Epcot for another show, for part two. I have goosebumps as I'm talking right now. Let's go and jump to another park. Let's talk about the studios, if you don't mind. We'll make this the Magic Kingdom Studio Show, if you don't mind.
Absolutely,
and we can talk about. So I know just enough to make me dangerous. Let's talk about Roger Rabbit's influence in Hollywood Studios, as at one point he was positioned to be like not as big as the Big Cheese, but pretty big. So let's talk about Roger for a while, if you don't mind.
Chris, I'm so glad you asked me about this because, you know, as you can imagine, I get asked a lot, what is my favorite concept that never came to be? And admittedly, you know, and this is probably the attorney in me too, that answer varies a lot. But in many cases, it's this Roger Rabbit's Hollywood concept because there's so much story that goes into it, and I think it just could have been fantastic. But, you know, again, kind of going back to this concept of context as king and knowing the context at the time, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was just an immensely popular breakthrough film in 1988. And unfortunately, I don't think people remember that now looking back on it. But it really was, I would say it was also a cultural phenomenon. And it was the second highest grossing film of the year in 1988 behind only Rain Man. Movies like Die Hard and Beetlejuice and some others, you know, people don't realize that Who Framed Roger Rabbit grossed a lot more money than those major films did. And it was the first film since Mary Poppins from 1964 that featured animation that won multiple Academy Awards. I just cannot, overstate the significance of that film. To some extent, a lot of people are familiar with the term the Disney Animation Renaissance, beginning with The Little Mermaid in 1989 and then continuing with Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast and other films. And I would certainly agree that all those films belong in that conversation. But I would argue that Renaissance began in 88 with Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And what was really, just kind of gets me excited about the concept is I think the thematic tie between that film and the studio's park was just perfect, right? I mean, both set in this golden era of 1930s, 1940s Hollywood. It just would have been fantastic. And when the studios first opened, and we may talk about some other concepts to this point as well, Disney executives themselves considered the park a half-day park, right? Because at the time, it was still a working studio. The attendance numbers just flooded in when the park opened, and so executives immediately started looking at how can we expand the park to essentially make it a full-day park for guests to visit. And one of these ideas was this entire subland called Roger Rabbit's Hollywood that would have been located, approximately in the area where the Rock and Roller Coaster and the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror are located today. From an attraction standpoint, what's great to think about is that this attraction would have this land would have included at least three separate attractions. A Toontown trolley, a simulator type attraction. A dark ride attraction featuring Benny the Cab, and then kind of the star of the show would have been Baby Herman's Baby Buggy Ride. And Chris, I don't know if you remember Baby Herman from the film, but he's the...
Who doesn't remember Baby Herman? Are you kidding me? Who doesn't remember him? Absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
the foul mouth, cigar smoking, diaper wearing baby that would have just been just a, I think, I kind of go into detail about what that ride would have been in the book, but just a very fun... a dark ride type attraction. And so when you look at it, it's like, man, we have this film that was tremendously popular. The character of Roger Rabbit across the country, extremely popular, and this perfect thematic fit into the studios. How in the world did this not actually happen? How did this not get built in the studios? And the answer to that, essentially goes to a dispute between the Disney company and then Steven Spielberg and his company, Amblin Entertainment. As they were getting ready to make this film, Michael Eisner, it wasn't the best time for Disney film production. And so he wanted to take a calculated risk to minimize kind of the downside for making this film. And so he reached a deal with Spielberg where they essentially, made the movie together. And as a part of that deal, the Disney company could not go and implement these characters into the parks without Spielberg's approval. Now, at the time, Eisner didn't see a downside to that because why in the world would Spielberg care about that? And then when the movie was very successful, they started looking at things they could do. While we never got a sequel to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I keep holding out hope
that
one day
we will. I want to say the word yet. If you want to see...
I hope when that happens.
If you want to see Disney's fans' faces melt off, just announce Who Framed Roger Rabbit Part 2, and the world would come to a cataclysmic stop, for sure.
Are you kidding? Including mine. but what you did get were three short films featuring Roger Rabbit. And the first of those was featured, before a Disney film that became quite popular. But the second one of those short films, there was a dispute. Disney wanted for that to be played in advance of what they thought was going to be their next blockbuster, Dick Tracy. And as you know, Chris, Dick Tracy, we talk about that in the book as well. Steven Spielberg, believe it or not, wanted this to play in front of a movie he was involved with called Arachnophobia, that, you know, for people who aren't familiar, it is not what I would call a family-friendly movie. It's about a spiders that, you know, that will scare you to death. And because of that dispute, they could never come to an agreement on implementing this Roger Rabbit's Hollywood concept into the studios. Now, you know, I think anyone knows the Disney company that, listen, you've got this worldwide hit, this perfect tie. Is there not a way that they could fight for the rights to put this in there or do some tough negotiations and get those into the parks? And this is just my educated guess, Chris, but what happened was is those other films we talked about started rolling out. Mm-hmm. The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and all these other films. And it's like, hey, we've got this plethora of IP here that we can use and know we're not going to get into a legal battle with Spielberg or anyone else about using those. And I think that's what happened. But I tell you what, if you look back at the marketing materials that the Disney company put out, if you look at the corporate disclosure documents that the company put out, they were absolutely in love with Roger Rabbit. As a matter of fact, the annual shareholder report, which is a disclosure document that the company puts out to its shareholders in 1988, it almost looks like a love letter between Roger Rabbit and Michael Eisner. I mean, you know, there's pictures of them everywhere. And even today in the parks, if you go into the park, you know, there's a Maroon Studios billboard in the studios that pays reference to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And there's a window with Roger Rabbit's silhouette cut out that references the Eddie Valiant Detective Agency. Mm-hmm. And those are all direct references to the Who Framed Roger Rabbit film. And really, if I could pick one concept that I think really should have been built, if it could have been at all possible, it's Roger Rabbit's Hollywood, because again, I think it would have been perfect for the studios.
Well, I don't know if listeners can really appreciate, we talked about it earlier, it was how big he really was. He was their golden boy. Like in the studios, Mickey Mouse, essentially, it was all started by a mouse. Except for this one period of time where everybody focused on Roger, and he was the man. So, yeah, pretty intense and amazing story. And I have to hope in the future there could be a Roger Rabbit Part 2. It would be amazing. And even right now, it's a testament to how well the movie was made, Bob Hoskins and Christopher Lloyd and whatnot. If you watch it now, it still is the kind of movie where you're watching, you say, man, that was really, really good. It doesn't look dated. It doesn't feel dated. It just feels like a really good, fun movie. And correct me if I'm wrong, was this one of the only times that you've got Disney characters and you've got other characters appearing in the same movie?
Yes, and that's a great point, especially the closing scene of the film that brings in, you know, Disney characters and Warner Brothers animated characters and Hanna-Barbera characters. And in the kind of the planning stages for the movie, they knew they wanted to do this. And really, Steven Spielberg was the only person who could have made that happen in terms of getting agreements with the different studios to let that happen. Mm-hmm. And it really is. I would encourage, you know, certainly if someone hasn't seen that film, I would encourage you to go watch it. But if you haven't seen it in a while, I would say to do that as well, because it really was a great film. And to your point, I think you said earlier that, hey, he was very popular and you know, not to replace Mickey Mouse, but you know, looking at the documents, we know this. They, you know, I don't want to say a Mickey Mouse equivalent, but they had, you know, he was going to be the Mickey Mouse of the studios, mm-hmm. without a doubt. And they felt very strongly about that. You know, walk around character was there in the park. And it was, it, you know, I cannot understate how big that would have been. But now, you know, we look, you know, so many decades later, and people have forgotten how significant that film was. But it had a tremendous impact on kind of the pop culture of the United States at that point, and Disney was ready to take advantage of that.
And before we leave Roger Rabbit, just going to give a special shout out for anybody who's between the ages of, say, 35 and 45, special shout out to Jessica Rabbit, because she opened our eyes and changed our perception of a character in an animated movie. So special shout out to my girl, Jessica Rabbit. So anyways, we're at the studios. What else can we learn? What else was planned and never built for the studios, Chris?
Well, you know, I'd mentioned Dick Tracy earlier, and I'll tie that in here. So, you know, again, this kind of went along the same lines of Roger Rabbit in terms of, you know, the swelling attendance numbers that the studios experienced from first opening, and needing an option to kind of bring some more things into the park to accommodate those guests. And Dick Tracy, you know. You know, the Disney company can sometimes sniff when they have a home run on their hands, right? You know, the Pirates of the Caribbean franchises turned out to be that. And they were convinced that the Dick Tracy film that was released in 1989 was going to be a huge home run. You know, it had it all. It had, you know, a comic book hero that generations of fans had loved. It had star power with Warren Beatty and Al Pacino and Madonna, and they just thought it was going to be a tremendous success. And so, as a part of that, they thought about adding a Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers area to the studios. And instead of the 1930s and 40s glitz and glamour of Hollywood, it would have been, you know, the 1930s, 1940s, you know, tough streets of Chicago, and would have featured, you know, because they thought it was going to be a blockbuster, Disney felt like the movie needed a blockbuster attraction to go with it. And so they developed this ride vehicle technology called EMV, Enhanced Motion Vehicle, that was essentially a motion simulator on wheels. And so even though this vehicle would be traveling on a flat surface, it could simulate very rocky or rough terrains. And essentially the ride vehicle that we can experience now in the dinosaur attraction in the Animal Kingdom. But it would have, this Dick Tracy concept would have taken you through, you know, the grimy streets of Chicago and through abandoned warehouses and the docks of Chicago, and would have included a Buzz Lightyear type shooter, right, where you could shoot at these different gangsters that were in the scenes, and they would have used, you know, the sounds of breaking glass, you know, to enhance the experience. And really, you know, based on what we've seen in the research, I think it would have been a great attraction. Well, the film ended up not meeting the standards of the Disney company. Now, when I say that, I think a lot of people who remember the Dick Tracy film have the misconception that the film was a flop, and that's not the case. I think the movie cost about $100 million to make, which was a significant sum back then, but it grossed over $170 million at the box office. The real problem was just Disney's expectations for that film, because they had looked at the original Tim Burton Batman film and the massive success that film was in terms of dollars. And, you know, kind of what ended up being a rollout of merchandise and sequel films. And Dick Tracy didn't live up to that standard. So, unfortunately, that combined with some potential legal issues where Warren Beatty, there was a dispute about whether or not he actually had the rights, to make the film from the original creator's family. was enough to make the company turn around and walk away. But think about that. I mean, how great would it have been to been in one of these attractions and, you know, in the Chicago gangster area? And again, a tie-in, you know, you did get some of that in the Great Movie Ride, but certainly not to the extent that Disney had originally planned.
Chris, what was your impression of the movie when you saw Dick Tracy when you were a wee lad? What did you think of the movie?
You know, I will say I was disappointed, I took enjoyment from it, but I had higher hopes than what it actually gave for me. I think they did a great job with the makeup and the characters, but it almost seemed, this is a bad statement, but it was almost too comical, right? As opposed to something that you could really get into.
I thought Al Pacino played a great role, and his name escapes me, but as the lead villain, Al Pacino played a great... I could picture his...
Big Boy Caprice.
Big Boy Caprice is right. I could picture his elongated chin and the way he reacted when he found... Spoilers. When he found the bug in the lampshade and whatnot. I could see his face now. And Madonna, I thought, played an excellent role. I never really bought Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy, though. He never had that dynamic... you know, Dick Tracy personality. But I remember, frankly, once you said, in my mind, I don't know why I did this, Dick Tracy, it matched with McDonald's because that was the marketing team at that time.
Yep.
And it was McDonald's Dick Tracy all over the place. So fascinating.
Well, to your point, you know, a lot of people don't remember this, but Al Pacino got a Best Supporting Actor nomination for his role in the film. So, I mean, clearly he did some good work there, and I think there were, to your point, some other very good acting performances. But when you combined everything together, including Beatty's performance, it just didn't work out the way that Disney thought that it would.
Gotcha. All right, so before we go, do you have one more story that you'd like to share from the studios or Magic Kingdom, of something you'd like to talk about that was never built? Give us one piece to leave with.
Yeah, so I'll finish up. Matt, when you put me on a spot like that, there's like 10 things I could talk about.
Give us two. We're good.
I'll say so. Muppet Studios for what was at the time MGM Studios, and what I think is really interesting about that is the close connection that the Disney company had with Jim Henson, who, you know, was the creator of the Muppets and, you know, Key and Sesame Street and so many other great things. And I think that everyone you would talk to in the Disney company at that time would tell you that Henson was cut from the same cloth as many of the Disney Imagineers. And there was a plan for, just an entire Muppet land that included, a Muppet-based attraction very similar to what we have now in the studios. But what I think would have been the crowning jewel would have been an attraction called the Great Muppet Movie Ride, and would have been a parody of the Great Movie Ride that opened with the parks, just instead with Muppets playing the key roles of the actors in these performances.
Man.
Would have been fantastic. And there's a couple pieces of concept art out there that show, you know, a scene from Peter Pan where Miss Piggy as Tinkerbell, and just hilarious type ideas that I think would have been wonderful. But what's interesting from a corporate history standpoint is that Disney and Henson were literally on the doorstep of finalizing a sale of Henson's company to Disney, and that's why you had some work and some collaboration going on already. In one of the corporate disclosure documents, it even announced that this deal was getting done and was going to happen. But unfortunately, Henson passed away before the deal closed. And, you know, as a corporate attorney who works on deals in my day-to-day practice, I can tell you there's a big difference between closing a deal and just having an agreement in principle, right? And it was really an unfortunate situation, that Henson's heirs and the Disney company couldn't come to an agreement on a sale afterwards. And so they instead just kind of licensed some limited rights to include, you know, the Muppet experiences that were there. Now, the Disney company did come back in later and finalize a sale many years later, but couldn't do it at the time. But man, that great Muppet movie ride, I think would have been fantastic.
Chris, and then Chris, the world is ready for that right now. Without the actual great movie ride to support it, the great Muppet movie ride would be fantastic right now. That we are completely ready for that.
Well, what's interesting is people, you know, when Star Wars Galaxy's Edge was first announced for the studios, there was a lot of fear, including by me, that, you know, that Muppet Vision 3D was going to get the axe. And who knows, that may happen in the future. I hope not. But really, Disney's reaction was to double down, right? Because you got Pizza Rizzo that opened up beside it, and you got, you know, the Muppet presentation, which is fantastic, in Liberty Square. And so they kind of, committed even further to the Muppets at that time. But I agree with you. Without an actual great movie ride in the park now, which I think, is sad, a Muppet version would be a home run.
Yeah, make us laugh. Star Wars is not designed to make us laugh. The Tower is not designed to make us laugh. Steven Tyler is not designed to make us laugh. Make us laugh. That always makes people, that's what makes us happy. So wonderful. Okay, I cheated. I said, give us one. Give us two. Give us one more. One more.
Well, here's the deal. I would be, there's no way I could let us get through a discussion about Magic Kingdom concepts that never came to be without talking about Fire Mountain and Villains Mountain.
Cool.
And just the amazing story that goes along with those. So, you know, when I first visited Disney World in 1983, by far my favorite attraction in the park was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. As a seven-year-old kid, actually getting to board a submarine and kind of live those adventures that I'd only kind of imagined beforehand, it really, it was just incredible. And that attraction remained extremely popular through the early 90s. Unfortunately, it was also a maintenance nightmare for the Disney company. And you also started having some handicap accessibility issues. And so 20,000 Leagues closed, I believe, in 1994. We didn't know it was a permanent closure until a couple of years later. And so you've got this massive plat of land, because 20,000 Leagues had a pretty big footprint in Fantasyland, but this large piece of real estate in the heart of Fantasyland that's not being used. And so, again, during this Michael Eisner era, the idea was, listen, we need some exciting attractions. We need something that's really going to bring in fans to the parks that are teens and adults and kind of get some energy going. And so what's great is that two different teams of Imagineers developed ideas for two different mountains that could have been located in Fantasyland. One was called Fire Mountain. And it was kind of based on the same, Jules Verne type fantasy and imagination that was represented in 20,000 Leagues. But it would have been a large volcano with a roller coaster that kind of run in and around and through through the volcano. The other idea was for a Villains Mountain. And so a mountain that took inspiration from Disney's 1940 film Fantasia and the Night on Bald Mountain segment from that film. I think you know this, Chris, but, the Disney villains are an extremely popular part of the Disney parks. And, Disney villains merchandise just kind of flies off the shelves.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that attraction, I think, still today would be amazingly popular. But here's what the super exciting thing is about this. At one time, and this is classic Eisner thinking, at one time he thought about adding both projects to the parks. Now, can you imagine that? This famed Disney mountain range that we all love, having two additional peaks, Fire Mountain and Villains Mountain. I mean, it would have been, it would have been fantastic. Well, both of those mountains never came to be, obviously, but for different reasons. The Fire Mountain concept, initially, Imagineers decided, I think rightfully so, that maybe that would be more appropriate in Adventureland as opposed to Fantasyland. But when they started tracking, an IP franchise to tie it to, they landed on a film called Atlantis that not a lot of people know about, that I think was a good film. Had Michael J. Fox featured as the lead voice character, but the film just never really, did what they hoped it might at the box office. And so with that, the Fire Mountain concept faded away. Villains Mountain was a little different because you know, I think Disney had even bigger hopes for a villain concept, whether it be, you know, the long rumored standalone park dedicated to villains, or at the very least, a land based on villains. And Disney didn't want to use this e-ticket type attraction in Fantasyland when they might need it for one of these other larger type projects. And then, as things tend to happen, none of those projects, the bigger villains projects, got off the drawing board and it faded into memory. But when you think about that, again, for me personally, it has a tie-in, because, you know, it was my favorite attraction as a child, the footprint of that ride and what could have been there with these two large mountains. Now certainly we have, you know, new Fantasyland at that location and all the things that go along with it. But the mountain range of the Magic Kingdom could have very well looked very differently than what we see today.
You know, the villains concept too. Periodically, a rumor will come around about a fifth gate and a villains park, and you think that's just crazy talk until you realize some of that was not only just briefly scripted, some of that was dang near finalized. And you think about the magnificent villain characters there are in Disney films, not even including guys that have been brought to the table, the Marvel villains and the Star Wars villains, but just simply the Jafars and the kind of draw an attraction, a land or a park would have with those, that would be amazing. Just amazing. So how exciting.
I'm convinced, and I don't know what it'll be, right? I won't project, you know, a full theme park, but I think at some point we will get a villains-based attraction somewhere, just because, again, the immense popularity, whether it's these villains dessert parties that happen from time to time, the Halloween season where they're extremely popular. Fans just love these Disney villains, and I think we'll get something that's dedicated to those at some point in the future. But man, a mountain, and I don't know if I said this, but you know, it essentially been a log flume type attraction. I think would have been fantastic to see in the park.
Fantastic. Okay, so Chris, again, remind everybody where we can find you, where we can find your books, and if they had any questions, how can we get a hold of you?
Sure. So the books you can get on Amazon.com, or you can visit my website, chrissmithbooks.com. And on my website, you can obviously, you know, learn more about me and my family and reach out to me with messages or comments if you have those. Love. That's been one of my favorite parts, Chris, about, you know, my books and to me, surprisingly, having the success that they've had is the interaction I get with Disney fans like me and you who just love these different types of Disney concepts. And then if they want to kind of follow me on a day-to-day basis and see cool pictures of construction photos or hidden Disney secrets, they can follow me at Twitter at @CSmithDisney.
Outstanding. So, you know what? I'm just going to take the steering wheel for 1 second here, and we're about to bring the show to a close. So, you know, we appreciate Chris joining us today. There's going to be a part two, guaranteed. We didn't touch base on Epcot. We didn't touch base on Animal Kingdom and Beastly Kingdom and Animal Kingdom. We didn't touch base on the resorts. We didn't touch base on a bunch of things. So there's definitely going to be another show, and there'll probably be a third show, because I'll probably ask Chris to come back and talk about his Secrets of the Magic Kingdom and a Walt Disney World book as well, too. But if you like the conversation, you know, I could easily see me devising a contest in our Facebook group. And we have a Facebook group, Chris, of our listeners, and it's a tight-knit community. It's called EDCOT, E-D-C-O-T. And if you're listening to the show and you like the show today and you want to participate with people who are like-minded and we have a good time, join us on EDCOT on Facebook. If you want to ask me any questions, you're going to contact me at WWReview on the Facebook, join EDCOT, or the WWReview on Twitter as well. We have an Instagram page. But if you have any questions for Chris and you can't get a hold of him or you forgot, send them to me. I'll make sure I get them in his hand. So I want to bring the show to a close. I want to thank you for your time today. So for this Chris, for that Chris Smith, we'd like to thank you, and we want to wish you a great day.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Man, had a ton of fun, and can't wait to get back on next time and talk about more of these fun ideas.
Awesome. Have a great day, everybody.